Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. You are tuned to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, November 12th. The House is back in session at this hour to vote on the Senate bill to end the shutdown. What should those who use SNAP benefits know about the latest Supreme Court ruling and the possible reopening of the government? The National Guard has joined efforts to fight the fire burning near Mauna Kea. We get the latest from the Big Island. And we hear about what some communities on Maui are doing to keep fire safe. Plus, Operation Baby Lift. We mark 50 years since Vietnamese children were adopted by American families. We hear the story of one of those children who was raised on Kauai. She is a woman on a mission. And we take you out to a ball game, baseball with a throwback feel. We'll explain. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At this hour, the House is set to go back in session to vote on whether or not to end the government shutdown, now the longest on record. It remains to be seen if lawmakers will swiftly pass the bill to reopen the government. So much has happened since last week's call-in show on The Conversation about the uncertainty around the food assistance programs. The Supreme Court extended a pause on the lower court ruling that instructed President Trump to fully fund SNAP, the federally funded food assistance program. Most of Hawaii's families on SNAP did get their November amount. We caught up with Joseph Campos, the Deputy Director for Human Services, to get the latest on the situation.
So the majority of people received the full amount. There is a gap group because we run the report on the 28th of the month. Anyone who was approved after the 28th did not receive the full SNAP benefit. However, the governor is committed to the state's Hawaii Emergency Food Assistance Program, and the people in the gap group from the 29th through the 10th of November, they will be receiving the $250 food assistance from the state, and that will show up on their cards probably later today or tomorrow with an activation date of this Friday, the 14th.
Okay, so not everybody got the $250 right away then.
People who were approved or on SNAP until October 28th got the full federal SNAP benefit as well as the state's $250 Hawaii Emergency Food Assistance Program. The people that were from the 29th through Monday the 10th, they will be getting the Hawaii Emergency Food Assistance Program at $250. And then they will, once we receive guidance from the USDA on how to proceed once the federal government opens, then they'll get their federal SNAP benefit.
Do we have a handle on how many are in that second group?
Yes, there were 2,800 cases, which is equivalent to about 6,700 individuals.
Okay.
And that's why the governor is committed to making sure that that group at least gets the Hawaii Emergency Food Assistance Program.
Is that second group a smaller number or a larger number of the whole section of families that are eligible for SNAP?
Yeah, the entirety of SNAP is approximately 88,000 households, which is equivalent to 169,000 individuals. And so the 2,800 cases, that's the small gap group from the 29th through the 10th.
Okay. And then just to be clear, because the Supreme Court handed down its decision pausing the full payment, how does that all work? I know initially you folks were saying if you can spend the $250 first under the Hawaii Relief Program, but what are you advising families right now?
We're advising families to utilize the funds that are showing up on their account. I know the AG office, the Attorney General's office, they're reviewing all of the court orders that have come, and we'll be deciding what to do.
And initially, we heard that the president was threatening to withhold funds from states that managed to get the payments through, the full payments. Heard anything about that?
Not since, I believe that was not X account, it was whatever his social media platform is. I believe it was a post on that. Since then, we haven't heard anything. There has been no guidance from USDA on that, or in that regards. And should there be any adverse effects, the state will review and assess and decide what action to take.
And then with the House taking its first vote on ending the shutdown, we do hear that sometimes there's a lag or a delay in the startup. How do you see that affecting the SNAP program?
So if the federal government opens up after this vote later this afternoon, more than likely there may be a delay. We will just need to wait for USDA guidance to inform us how to move forward.
So stay tuned. That was Human Services Deputy Director Joseph Campos talking to us about what SNAP recipients need to know about receiving that food assistance money in their accounts. Campos says a group of some 6,000 individuals in Hawaii should see money in their EBT accounts later today or tomorrow.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Are you passionate about local journalism? Skilled at identifying a range of voices and perspectives? HPR is hiring a full-time producer to work on The Conversation, our flagship daily news and talk show. Read the full job description and apply at hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
The National Guard is using three of its helicopters to help battle the blaze on the Big Island, which has been raging since Friday. Here to talk about the situation on her home island is HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what's the latest? How much has this blaze claimed there on the Big Island?
Yeah, so this far, it's on the eastern slopes of Mauna Kea, and as of this morning, it's burned about 2,100 acres. And it's currently about 65% contained. So there is a perimeter, but it is still burning in the interior. And it's a really remote fire. So they have a lot of resources that they've had to bring in partnership with state, county, and federal to keep it under control. And I was heard about this fire, funny enough, because I was already reporting on wildfires and brush fires on Hawaii Island on Friday when this fire broke out. I specifically was looking at the region of Hamakua, which is on the northern part of Hawaii Island, a little bit north of where this fire currently is. And then midday on Friday, I was in contact with the Hawaii Fire Department, Civil Defense. They stopped calling me back because they had to work on this fire. But what's happening at Hamakua is really interesting as well. They're having kind of an extraordinary fire season. This year, the region has had three times as many fires as it usually does. And Fire Chief Kazuo Todd says that normally around this time of year, his department has responded to between 15 and 30 fires in that area. But when they crunched the numbers for me last week, they counted up 92 fires so far this year. And Todd said that those fires are a result of human activity.
Humans are what cause fires. It's accidental, like pulling over the car and the catalytic converter or whatever, lighting up the bushes as your car sits there running on the side of the road. It's people throwing cigarettes. It's people not taking care of their cooking fire when they're off hunting out in the the wilderness. And then also sometimes it's people starting fires.
Starting fires is in deliberately?
Yes. Kazuo Todd does think that some of these fires were started on purpose, but he cannot prove it.
There's a heavy suspicion when you get three fires in one night, all in the same region, and there's no evidence, really. I can tell you it's arson, but, you know, I can't necessarily prove it is arson because these fires start in the middle of nowhere, generally at the side of a road, and they all start, you know, oftentimes within a very close time proximity. We'll have one fire burning, and then all of a sudden there's another fire in another location, also usually right next to a road. But there's no witnesses because these people, you know, we have a very big island, so it allows, you know, the people that are starting fires to essentially go out somewhere where no one is around them, on a road that no one's on, start a fire and leave without ever being seen. Based on the timing, location, I can tell you that that is essentially what's going on. It's just telling you who did it and why they're doing it is a totally different thing.
And that's pretty disturbing. I mean, particularly since, you know, just coming off the Maui fire and all the loss of life that we watched happen.
Yeah, and we can't determinately say that they're seeing such a spike in wildfires because of arson activity. But what we can say is whether or not people are intentionally starting fires or just doing reckless behaviors like tossing cigarettes or leaving fires unattended, the drought conditions that Hamakua is facing are making wildfires more likely and making ignitions more likely to extend into a bigger blaze. So Hamakua it's on the wet windward side of Hawaii Island, so it's generally very lush and green. And historically, its coastline has gotten around 100 inches of rainfall per year. But really, in the last 4 years, it's been contending with a serious decline of rainfall and drought. And the U.S. Drought Monitor even ranks some parts of Hamakua as being in D3 extreme drought, which is the second highest level that they measure. And Todd says these conditions could be resulting in more fires.
In the past, we've had people, you know, pulling over or throwing cigarettes or starting campfires. And, you know, because of the dampness, because this is generally the wet side of the island, it's just never transitioned into a wildland fire. It, you know, self-extinguishes. The conditions aren't there and ripe for it. So because the fact that, you know, this region had been in like D3 drought and just it's been super dry, every little thing can potentially start a fire and actually transition it into a full-blown wildland fire.
Oh, gosh. And then when the winds hit, right? I mean, that just makes it worse.
Right. And this is actually what they think likely happened with one of the largest fires that has broken out in Hamakua so far this year. So this started in September in a remote forest reserve. And Todd says the origin was likely a cigarette or an untended cooking fire from a hunter. And so that fire burned about 600 acres. And even though it was 2 months ago, his firefighters are still up there at nights to monitor it for hotspots.
The reason, you know, we are still on scene is that kukui grass, which is in the area, and the drought conditions have allowed it to kind of just pop up every now and then. So it's slowly smoldering underground. And then every now and then, you know, a patch of grass starts to smoke. And then our crews just need to hang out because it's a 45-minute response time. We need to have people on scene present in case it starts to rekindle and start a fire because we don't want it to escape.
And if Hamakua has been dealing with this drought situation for, 4 years or so? I mean, so is this a shift that we're seeing, you know, these drier conditions? Is it part of climate change?
So that's a great question. And I think that's kind of top of mind for everyone. And I took that question to analysts with the Pacific Drought Knowledge Exchange and the Hawaii Climate Data Portal. Their analysts work closely together. And the Hawaii Climate Data Portal, it has rainfall records that go back to 1991. And one of their climate analysts, Cheryl Hugh, told me that, yes, Hamakua is facing an unprecedented drought. This is the driest Hamakua has been in terms of precipitation on record. But rainfall patterns, they're extremely variable. The data is really hard to parse because it changes year to year and you have different climatological effects like La Niña, El Niño that affect rainfall overall. So she really thinks it's too soon to say if Hamakua is going to have a drier climate going forward and if we're seeing shifts that are directly a result of climate change. And This is true beyond just Tamakua also. This is a question people are asking about the entire state. So, for instance, this August was remarkably dry, people might remember. It was actually the first time in 50 years that there was no measurable rainfall in Honolulu. That's using a rain gauge near the airport. And there were many, many places across Hawaii Island, Oahu, Maui, that were the driest that they had been on record. That made sense to people to think, oh, we're seeing these prolonged droughts. This is probably a result of climate change. But in general, when you speak to the experts, they say the jury is still out on whether or not climate change is permanently reducing rainfall in parts of Hawaii Island. I also spoke with Derek Ford. He's with the Pacific Drought Knowledge Exchange, and he told me that there is one way that climate change is clearly impacting wildfire conditions, and that's air temperatures. So the air, how hot the air is, has been trending up consistently, and those higher air temperatures are drying out moisture in the landscape, which is making things more flammable.
Yeah, except for like this weekend. I mean, it's been raining cats and dogs over, you know, here on Oahu, and I know my plants are drowning right now. And the wind has been just really crazy. So I know that those are the conditions that officials are closely watching.
And we've seen rains on the west side of Hawaii Island, which is traditionally drier. That's the leeward side. But because these drought conditions are in the areas that are particularly wet, there's more vegetation there that Kuzuo Todd says it makes it harder to contend with these wildfires when they break out. And we are in November. This is traditionally the start of wet season. And NOAA is predicting above average rainfall for the winter. But Derek Ford with the Pacific Drought Knowledge Exchange says because of how dry it's been, it's going to take more than a few months of rain to end the drought in Hamakua. We need a sustained return of rainfall.
All right. Well, hopefully we don't get any more fires. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote with the latest on the Big Island fire situation. This week, Honolulu Civil Beat has several stories related to fire. Today, reporter Erin Nolan joins us. She covers Maui for Civil Beat. Good morning, Erin.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and you know, you had a story that ran yesterday talking about the water tanks that they're trying to deploy around the island just to help fight these fires.
They just set up the first two new permanent water tanks in Ma'alaya.
Well, yeah, talk about, these tanks and have they had to put them in use yet?
So the first two tanks in Ma'alaya, they're on the right off the Hanawa Pi'ilani Highway across from Ma'alaya Harbor, sort of near the entrance to the Lahaina Pali Trailhead. The State Department of Land and Natural Resources, they put those two tanks. It's a 30,000-gallon storage tank and a 10,000-gallon helicopter dip tank over there. And I heard about a week ago, they were about halfway full, but they were fully operational. If there were a fire, they could be used. And yeah, there are plans to fill them up completely, and they would be able to be used if a helicopter needed to get water to attack from the air.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen those in place here on this island, but how many do they plan to put in across Maui? Do you know?
Yeah, so between the county government and the state, they're planning on somewhere between 10 and 15 water tanks. That'll depend on cost and how difficult the terrain is where they end up deciding to put them and where they have access to water resources. So whether that's a reservoir nearby or the county water supply or a well, that'll all play into it.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen those dip tanks, and sometimes in some cases the helicopters, you know, just take ocean water if they're close by.
Yeah, so both the assistant fire chief on Maui and official from the State Department of Land and Natural Resources talked about that, and it is something that's been done in the past, but they said logistically it's really complicated because they should, if they're taking water from the ocean, shut down the highway before they travel over it with a full load of water. So it just is much less complicated if they're able to collect water above the highway and go from there.
Yeah, and then if you can situate these tanks in the interior parts of the island, right? I mean, that's just a big help.
Yeah, they're planning on putting them sort of on the Mauka side of the Pi'iwani Highway in South Maui, a few in West Maui, and even they're talking about some places further up country and at higher elevations. So, yeah, that would mean a lot less road closures and just getting water to fight fires faster.
And you also have a story that ran today about a Maui church that's helping out to house some of the volunteers that are helping with the recovery there on Lahaina.
Yeah, Po'okele Church in Makawao, they just hosted their first group of volunteers last week. They're four volunteers from Oahu. It's so expensive right now to try and rent a short-term housing situation on Maui, and that's really prevented a lot of people who wanted to help with the fire recovery from getting here. So Reverend Dr. Kimberly Fong at Po'okele Church is the first church to be officially designated by a national organization or certified by this national organization, Presbyterian Disaster Assistance, to actually house volunteers. So they put reclining chairs in a bunch of wherever there was space, in pastoral offices, in even the main worship area. They replaced two sets of pews with about a dozen recliners. And yeah, that is where the volunteers have been sleeping. And that has been the reason they've been able to help out. They spent 4 days in Kula helping with recovery efforts there and 1 day in Lahaina.
Well, I know you, besides these two stories, I know Christina Jedra has another story about a fatal fire that happened here. But yeah, maybe we can drive our listeners to check out those stories. But thank you so much, Erin.
Yeah, no problem.
We've been talking with Honolulu Civil Beat's Maui reporter Erin Nolan. You can find those stories online at civilbeat.org.
Hey, Yo-Yo, did you know that your cello can talk to whales?
I wish.
Yo-Yo's cello is going to be connected to a speaker. If we're lucky, we'll pick up some humpback whale song.
I'm Ana Gonzalez, and I've been traveling around this country with Yo-Yo Ma for the past few years. In Hawaii, we went out on a boat with scientists and musicians.
I think my job was whale chantress.
To communicate through space and time with humpback whales. Listen to Our Common Nature from WNYC wherever you get podcasts.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
As we come off Veterans Day, we have a war story to share. It was 50 years ago that thousands of Vietnamese children were airlifted to begin new lives in the United States. Thousands were airlifted as part of Operation Baby Lift. They would eventually be adopted by American families. It was a program started by President Gerald Ford. Here he is at a press conference talking about the operation shortly after it took place.
And I am very proud of those governors, like Governor Pryor of Arkansas, Governor Askew of Florida, Governor Longley of Maine, Governor Evans of Washington, Governor Oroshi of Hawaii, as well as Mayor Alioto, who have communicated with me and indicated their support for a policy of giving the opportunity of South Vietnamese to come from this country to escape the possibility of death in their country under the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. And individuals who wanted an opportunity for freedom. I think this is the right attitude for Americans to take, and I'm delighted for the support that I've gotten.
Devaki Murch was one of those babies in Operation Baby Lift. She can't express enough how lucky she feels to have grown up on Kauai. She lives in Utah now, but we spoke with her earlier this month. Murch was featured in a PBS film about Operation Baby Lift, and she is a woman on a mission today. She is reconnecting many of the children with their adoption records. Murch was on the first plane load, which tragically crashed. More than 100 people died, including 70 children, but she survived. She recalled meeting the many veterans who were part of Operation Baby Lift, from pilots of the planes to nurses, who all played a role in helping the displaced children find a new life. Here's Devaki Murch sharing her story.
I was brought over to Kauai when I was 9 months old, when my mom picked me up from the Presidio in San Francisco. I was brought straight home to the south side on Kauai and raised on an 8-acre farm that we still own. Growing up on the island was magical because it was the 1970s and 80s where kids all ran free, and you go up and down all the streets. If you get tired driving, riding home, someone will pick you up, put your bike in the back of their truck, and drive you home. It was the most amazing community in Ohana that you could ever ask for as a child, because you had all the aunties and uncles, everybody took care of you, but most of all, I looked like a local kid. I was a local little kid growing up, and there was not a huge difference between me and everybody else. Whereas as I'm learning and meeting others that have grown up in the United States, on the mainland, it was much more difficult. There were so many more racial biases and challenges that continue to this day that I never even knew existed growing up as a little local kid.
Share with our listeners your story, because you were airlifted out on that first flight from Vietnam, and that plane crashed.
Yes, I was a part of the initial flight that President Ford set up through the official Operation Baby Lift in April 3rd, 1975. The flight took off from Saigon on April 4th. The C-5A plane had come in and dropped its existing load of a bunch of howitzers and picked up a bunch of babies. All of the children had been laid out in boxes on the tarmac, the infants getting ready to get loaded onto the plane, and then they were all brought onto the plane. Most of the younger children that were just younger and they couldn't manipulate a seatbelt, they were up on the troop compartment. The older children and a lot of adults were all in the cargo area. The plane was in the air for about 12 and a half minutes, and the rear cargo door blew out. The hydraulics failed. And so the pilot turned the plane around, managed the best he could to stabilize the plane, going up and down when, you know, everything was losing power, the hydraulics, the electrical. And he crash landed on one side of the Saigon River, losing the landing gear, hopped over the Saigon River, and crash landed, breaking the plane into multiple bits. It landed on its belly, crushing the whole cargo compartment. The troop compartment sheared off, stayed upright, and went in one direction. The cockpit broke off and flipped. When the pilot got out of the plane, and he survived as well as the co-pilot, they peeked out the window and they looked down, and what was supposed to be a 30-foot drop was now about a 4-foot drop. because they're upside down.
Wow. There were 138 people killed in that crash, and I'm reading of 78 children, but you survived. And so talk about how you ended up here in Hawaii.
So my mother couldn't have children, and she knew that she always wanted a baby. So in January 1975, my grandmother sent her a New York Times article that listed about five different adoption agencies that you could go through to adopt a Vietnamese baby. And my mother applied, or wrote to apply for to be considered for a child. And it took about a year that she was offered several options for children, but she also knew her capacity of not being the best mother for a special needs child, which she had been offered, and she knew that was not going to be her kuleana and how she was going to deal with it. She couldn't. She opted to wait, and then in January 1975, she was mailed a little picture of me with my information, and was basically I was assigned to her, and my orphanage name was Mimosa.
What was it like when she heard about this crash?
Growing up, when you're a child, you don't think about that kind of a thing. You don't think about what a mother, an adult, goes through in their application process, the waiting period, knowing that you're assigned a baby, knowing that your baby is now going to depart on April 4th, and the next thing, you know, you're getting all ready to go. She had to fly from Kauai to San Francisco, so she's getting ready to go, and the next thing that you know is your baby's plane crash, and you don't know if you still have a child. You're in San Francisco. You don't know what condition your child's going to be in when they arrive. And so that has been a really interesting conversation as I've gotten older to really delve into that, because I never really thought about it growing up. So in 2024, I knew that the 50th year commemoration of the end of the war and also of the plane crash was coming up. And I really wanted to do something. I wanted to say thank you to everyone that brought us over, the people that were instrumental in us existing, the people who took care of us, the pilot who landed our plane. And I thought that creating a notebook of gratitude would be a great present to them, a way to say thank you. And I approached one of the nuns who took care of us. She also worked for Friends for All Children, which was the adoption agency that I was adopted through. And she liked it. And she said, honey, that's a great idea, the notebook, thank you notes, thank you so much. But she said, what I really need help with is I have all of these boxes in my basement, and we need to figure out what's going to happen with them when I'm gone, because she is 81 years old. And so we need to figure out where they're going to go and what's going to happen. So we started researching different options of the final place for these files, which are the different repositories. We looked at Regis University in Denver, which has an affiliation with the Sisters of Loretto, which Sister Mary Nell Gage is a part of. I actually, by accident, walked into the Library of Congress manuscripts building looking for the tour, and ended up speaking with someone, and they were interested in taking the collection, but they only wanted a partial collection, not the full collection, which includes the adoptee files. And then the Gerald Ford Museum has a lot of different information, but a lot of that is much more specific to Operation Baby Lift proper, which is from April 3rd until April 30th. Operation Baby Lift, we call it capital, is during that duration of time. But Operation Baby Lift lowercase is the evacuation of the children from 1967 to 1975. It's the children that were all brought out of Vietnam, not just during that 1 month.
Well, you shared with me earlier that when you went to this woman's house to look at the files and you opened up a box, your file was on the top.
Yeah, this whole project has been these crazy serendipitous moments. And she had gone down to the basement, grabbed a whole chunk of files, and brought them up, plopped them on the kitchen table. And I said, so is my file in there? And she's like, yeah, somewhere. And so I reached out and I grabbed the first one and I opened it up and I'm like, mommy, because it was my mother's handwriting. And it was her letter requesting to be considered to adopt a child. And in that file was nothing that I didn't know, but it was a history of the home studies, the applications, the medical records on me, my footprints, stuff that I had never seen before. And for some reason, they had like my class pictures from Kahili Adventist School in like second and third grade. My mom must have sent them.
Wow. You have spent, what, more than a year trying to get the files that you came across into the hands of the children that were involved in Operation Baby Lift. And you'll be coming home in December, but you hope to share those stories and actually deliver some of those files.
Yeah. What we're doing right now, because I have a lot of the transportation lists, ID lists, and really logistical paperwork all scanned. And the 30 boxes of adoptee files is very daunting because that is a lot of scanning to do by one person. So what I'm doing is going through the key lists of people who have inquired for their records, people that we know, and then looking at the plane crash children, because that's a subset of all of these adoptees that's a little more attainable to look for the individuals, but also look for their files. And so what I do is I scan their file, and then we reach out to them. And my goal is what I actually have done this last weekend. And I go and I meet one of the individuals, and we sit down, and I present their information to them in a clasp envelope in a folder, and I allow them to open up that piece of their history on their own time. So rather than just emailing or even mailing it, it's really kind of a ceremonial thing where you're giving someone a piece of their history and you're allowing them the space and time to see it when they're ready.
Yeah, to process it.
I realized how important that is.
Yeah.
And even with the lists, I have things. If I was going to come and see you, I'll prepare and I'll put little post-it arrows wherever your name is on those lists, but I still will give you the stack of all the different lists in their folders and let you look through it, because it's really important for people to see how many people were involved, how many children were in the orphanages. There's handwritten lists that have the children of a nursery, and then post-plane crash, it's written in by hand, alive, dead, alive, dead, alive, dead. And it's intense. And as a survivor, when you see your name and then a little note that just says alive in hospital, you're like, wow, that's me.
Well, were you able to, I don't know, find out anything about your family in Vietnam?
No, and that's a lot of this project is what I'm after is what I have the evidence and data for, and that is the logistical journey of a child from Saigon to their destination. As far as the family searches, there's some wonderful organizations that are doing family searches, matching the adoptee to the parents in Vietnam through DNA searches. It's really amazing. I personally have never felt the need to find my birth family because I've had such a wonderful, fulfilled life growing up, and I have an amazing family to this day.
Now that was Devaki Murch, one of the babies on part of Operation Baby Lift. Murch plans on returning home to Hawaii in December and is in the process of setting up talks here in Honolulu and on Maui. Check back later for updated information. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to a Hawaiian thrush who have mastered the art of camouflage.
The Oma'o, or Hawaiian thrush, is found only in the native rainforests of the Big Island. It's a mostly gray and brown robin-like bird that loves to eat fruit from a variety of native trees and shrubs, and plays a big role in helping disperse the seeds of these species throughout the forest. Oma'o have one of the loudest and most recognizable songs of any Hawaiian forest bird. They have a huge repertoire of songs, and every individual sings differently. All the Hawaiian Islands used to have their own species of thrush, but unfortunately, Kauai is the only other one where they've not yet gone extinct. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Baseball, old school style. We featured the Aloha Vintage Baseball Association last year when the idea for a league that celebrated 19th century rules and uniforms was still in the planning phases. The nonprofit league put together the Kalakaua Cup this past weekend at Cartwheel Field. The Conversation's Maddie Bender attended the inaugural game.
The crack of a 40-ounce bat rings out over Cartwright Field in Makiki. The balls hit deep to center, and the fielder misses the catch. It may have been a routine pop fly for a typical outfielder, but this isn't your typical baseball game. The fielder's mitt is barely larger than a gardening glove, and he's wearing a heavy wool uniform with the word Waikiki emblazoned across the chest. Meanwhile, the umpire is dressed in his Sunday best, complete with a waistcoat and dress shoes. The Aloha Vintage Baseball Association organized the Kalakaua Baseball Jubilee for its inaugural tournament. The new league celebrates our favorite pastime as it was played in 1886, during the time of Alexander Joy Cartwright. Cartwright is often called the father of modern baseball. He spent most of his life in Hawaii and served as an advisor to King David Kalakaua and Queen Emma. So it seemed fitting that on a recent Saturday, four teams in period uniforms faced off around the baseball diamond. The Waikikis took on the San Francisco Pelicans, while the Barbary Coasters battled the Royals. The Royal Hawaiians, that is. Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi spoke at the tournament's opening ceremony.
Well, we're really excited because, you know, this is sort of reliving history, if you will. We dedicated the field a few months ago, having validated and authenticated the fact it's the oldest active baseball field in America. And now to have these teams come in here, dressed the way they are, I mean, this is just really cool. This doesn't go on in a whole lot of places. So really, a week after the World Series and all that got conjured up about the love of baseball and just how great a game it is, to be able to go back and have a moment like this on this field, understanding the historical significance of it, somewhere out there, King Kalakaua and Alexander Cartwright are smiling.
Parks Department spokesperson Nate Sirota was also in the crowd.
And I mean, even so, the official designation of Cartwright Field happened fairly recently.
Yep, it was actually last April. It was Cartwright's birthday party.
Look at that.
Yeah, I think it's a home run. Yeah. Awesome. These guys are remarkably good. Yeah, those bats are no joke too. Heavy wooden bats. And it's crazy to think about how the rules were different, right? You got seven balls as opposed to four to go to base. You can get hit by a ball and not get an automatic base. And of course, just these old school uniforms. It's really cool. It kind of takes you back to that bygone era. And not just the players too, but you see the aunties and the muumuus. Even, I mean, the umpire here wearing a vest. Like, when are you going to see umpire in khakis, a lei, and a vest like that? It's just really cool to see this out here.
Paula Weaver makes historic baseball uniforms. She came all the way from Connecticut just to watch the new teams wear her creations out on the field. She says Aloha Vintage Baseball Association Vice President Chester Sebastian roped her into the project.
And, so I gave him pricing and everything, and we were talking back and forth by email. And I said, Chester, can I please call you? Your time, 9 in the morning. And I called him, and he was floored, like he was talking to some celebrity. And back and forth, we figured out the uniforms, and I started making them for the two teams. And when he called me and said, we're doing a jubilee, you know, we'll send you tons of photos. 2 hours later, I called him back. I said, I just booked a flight from JFK. I'm coming. So it was a tough 11-hour flight, but I made it. So went right to the museum and got to meet the guys and and gave them some new uniforms that they're having next. So, but no, I loved it. Never been here before, so, and couldn't wait for today so I could see all of them. I made the Pelicans too from San Francisco, so I got to meet those guys.
Richard Johnson plays for the Royals. He explains some of the quirks of the game.
You play with a minimum 40-ounce bat. The gloves, obviously. I mean, nothing more than a glorified oven mitt. The biggest aspect of it, too, is when the striker comes to the line, the ump will ask them, do you want high or low? You get to determine what the strike zone is. So, yes, that does give you, does give the batter an advantage, but the pitcher, the hurler also has an advantage as well. Because they can do different arm windups, things like that. So you still have your fastballs and your curveballs and palm balls and things like that. Now, the other thing you can do is you can throw spitters. If you've got a piece of emery board or something in the back pocket, use it. Piece of sandpaper, all good. Ball manipulation is encouraged. Another example is that if you look at Solario's gloves, he's wearing two gloves, right? Both of them are chock full of pine tar. Technically, in modern baseball rules, you would not be putting pine tar on your gloves because that would infringe on the ball.
Tomfoolery is encouraged in vintage baseball. A minute later, we see a prime example of these hijinks. It's a blink and you'll miss it moment. A runner on third base gets called out.
Oh, hidden balls!
Yep.
Hidden balls!
Hidden ball trick.
Wait, what just happened?
It's called a hidden ball trick. So the third baseman never gave the ball back to the pitcher. So guy stepped off the bag, tagged him out. 100% legal. Players still use it today, but you don't see it very often because players are like, unless they're fooling around. But that stuff is very encouraged.
That's fun. It's kind of rowdy. It's kind of like baseball that doesn't take itself too seriously.
And I think that's the cool thing about it is that, yeah, nobody does take themselves too seriously. Like, everyone's here to have fun. Like I said before, right, we have guys who played in college, right? We've got guys who just played high school. We got guys who never even stepped foot on a Little League field. They just love baseball. And how can't you get romantic about baseball, right?
Come on! There you go! Good ginger there, Solario! Good one, Butcher!
Musician Trish Nollet, a.k.a. Lox, plays outfield with the Royals. She played Little League as a kid and says she was excited to get back into the game.
So I was like, well, you looking for players? Is it co-ed? And they go, yeah. And I was like, well, sign me up. And then I just started posting about the whole baseball league, and I actually convinced some of my friends from my childhood to play.
What's it been like to play so far, you know, having grown up playing baseball?
Honestly, my first game, I was scared because I haven't played since I was 16 years old. I'm 34. So you already know your body is not going to work like it used to. You know what I mean? So I was already knowing I'm going to be sore. I hurt a lot more, but I feel like a kid again. I've been smiling cheek to cheek. I miss the game so much. And being a female in this sport, it's difficult in general. And like vintage style is difficult because the bats are heavier. So it's been a little struggle, but I'm keeping up with the men's. We're having fun out here. And nobody hates me, so that's a great thing. It's a great thing for me. And this bar too, I'm ready to see some people smack the ball out of the field with these heavy bats. It's nuts.
Oh!
Matias Solario is the commissioner of the Aloha Vintage Baseball League and first baseman for the Waikikis.
How do you even start to talk about what you've been up to since like a year ago?
Well, it's gotten a lot easier now that we have something to show for it. That was always the most difficult part, is just having to describe exactly what this is. It takes a lot of explaining, but, you know, now that we have tangible proof of, you know, what we're doing, you know, it's been a really easy job to get recruits, to get players, to get fans to come out and just to see, you know, how cool this is, because it kind of sells itself at this point. It's exploded, and we're already looking to expand to other islands.
Are you serious?
Yeah. So we're gonna add two more teams here, and then Hilo is probably the closest. So they have over a full squad, and then they're pretty close in Kona too. We just have to organize all that and put them together.
There's some really cool additions to the way you guys are playing since the last time we spoke. The inclusion of Olelo Hawaii, for instance. Talk a little bit about what that will look like.
You know, when this thing first started, it was just going to be a recreational league, and we were going to dress up in old-timey uniforms and, you know, maybe pay some slight lip service to history. But, you know, once we just scratched the surface and kind of got a little bit of a chip on our shoulder about Hawaii's place in the game and how it's not really being recognized, it was really easy to create a narrative around the sovereign era and what that means to Hawaii, what the game of baseball means to Hawaii and vice versa. And so we just really want to, you know, push that as far as possible. And, you know, in addition to being a recreational league, we'd like for this to be an educational league as well.
The Pelicans defeated the Waikikis in the first game, and the players tipped their hats to the umpire. Major League Baseball is undergoing significant changes to bring it into the modern era. But Johnson says one way the game can chart a path forward is by looking backwards.
I feel like nowadays we talk a lot about the future of especially something like Major League Baseball, transitioning from human umps to robot umps, things to make the game faster and quote-unquote more engaging, more entertaining. This seems, at least to me, to be a little bit of a rebuke to that, but what are your thoughts?
It kind of is, right? It is, we are going backwards, but that's the point, right? Like, this is, by itself, this is history, right? And sometimes we have to go backwards to go forwards. What we're trying to, I think, remind people of is that people nowadays want baseball to move at a fast pace because it needs to. We have to get to commercial breaks. We've got to. People want to see action, right? People want to see that. Baseball is not about action. It's about strategy and just the love of the game. Like, you can't tell me that a Major League Baseball player coming up did not. Just at one point in time did not care about money, right? They wanted to just go play. And that's kind of what we're doing, is we're just here to truly play. The fact that, like, we've got players out here that played in college, and then we've got players out here that...
The balls hit deep to center. The runner rounds third. He's going home.
Those were the players at the inaugural Kalakaua Cup this past weekend. The Aloha Vintage Baseball Association is looking for players for its upcoming season. Learn more and see photos from the tournament on our website later today.
Take me to the park and out to the ball game, the ball game.
Nah, you wouldn't like it.
Yeah, rag a shop with the crowd real loud.
That'd explain everything.
Buy me soda, pop, and peanuts, and buy Cracker Jack.
A hat'll cost
me. I don't ever care if I never get back.
That's different. We'll root for the home.
We are all out of time, so we have to go. But up tomorrow, we plan to hear from the Hawaiian Council and the Office of Hawaiian Affairs about their emergency relief fund with all the government shutdown uncertainty. Are you or anyone you know affected by the shutdown? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.